Session number 14806, Eddie Murray, part 32.
And so do you think that, if he was in power and in control of everything, that he wasn't fussed so much?
No, he wasn't fussed so much, do you see? And so he was not despondent because he always felt, and I was never in the cabinet rooms, of course, when they were discussing these things, but I always felt that this was the way it went about, that they would argue about things, and he understood that people had their certain reasons for certain arguments that they put forward.
Yes.
And so this was legitimate, but it was also legitimate for him to have the final word.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were thousands of times when he gave way, you know, to other people's ideas.
His health and the strokes and so forth. He certainly had two strokes, didn't he?
Well, I think he had five at least.
Really? There were only two or three main publicised ones. I say publicised, noted, they weren't publicised at the time.
Well, yes, two particular ones, one down in Monte Carlo and one, of course, down at Chartwell. But there were others. But to tell you the truth, do you see that although his health did mean something to me, there was absolutely nothing that I could do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had nurses there for that specific purpose, and a doctor who was always on call, and other doctors that could be touched by Lord Moran if there were any complications arising. But actually, although they interested me personally, as far as my duties were concerned, they didn't touch me at all.
No.
If he was ill, he was going to stay in.
Yeah.
And that actually was a help to me, because that relieved me of certain duties.
What about Lord Moran and other reports saying that Churchill basically was completely past it, even when he was in Prime Minister, if not before?
Well, I've got Moran's book, you know, but I've never read it. And the thing I've got against Moran, you see, is that although he might have performed a very, very good job during the war and prior to the war and shortly after the war, and it's immaterial, really, because he wasn't there sitting by his bedside the whole of the time during 15 years. I mean, he used to visit, and when he was sick, he would visit for a little while. But if Churchill was ill, then if it was the head, then Moran would take the phone and get in touch with Lord Brain, whose son, as a matter of fact, is a personal friend of ours, is now living down in Newton Abbot yonder. So we often talk about Churchill. You see, if it was his chest, then he'd get in touch with another specialist. But Moran himself did nothing at all. He just carried out the instructions of bigger men than him, who were keeping abreast, who were more modern, and keeping abreast of everything that was happening, do you see, in the medical world. And so this is always what I'd felt, that how could Moran write a book like that, saying that it was his, you know, personal experience, whereas during the last 15 years of his life, as far as I'm concerned, everything that Moran knew about Churchill's illnesses was second and third hand, because the nurse would be there. The nurses who were there 24 hours a day, do you see, from an agency. And so one of them would be there when the stroke happened or something like this, and he'd make a note of it in his book, and he'd put all the notes. Do you see, there would be a notebook there, and Moran would refer to the notebook. So, but if the nurse was going off duty, then he'd pass that nurse book on to a next nurse, and then that nurse might be responsible for getting Moran.
What about a bit of just as a side issue, that nowadays presumably you wouldn't be able to, I mean, no disrespect to the nursing profession, it's disrespect to human nature, that I mean, that nowadays you couldn't guarantee, vouch for anybody's keeping their mouth shut, especially especially somebody engaged on a casual basis like an agency nurse.
Well, Howells, of course, wrote a book.
Oh, really? But that was afterwards.
After he died.
Yeah. But it wasn't, but I mean, nowadays, somebody would
Didn't give out very much information.
No, it would work for 6 months, and then you'd see it in the Star or the Sun or something.
And so how could I, do you see, profess to know anything about his health as far as the press
was
concerned?
What about his mentally being on the ball and so forth?
Well, now then, they said that at least 4 or 5 days before he died, he was in a coma.
Mm.
He died on the Sunday morning. On the Saturday morning, I went in there, as usual, into his bedroom, because I had keys, you see, to go in. And Howells, the male nurse, was in there. And I knocked on the door and opened it and walked in. And Howells announced, you see, Sergeant Murray, Sir Winston. And there was no response coming from that figure that was lying in that bed, flat on his back, and with his hands crossed on his chest. See, no response. So, you know, I stepped forward. I knew nothing at all about him having been in a coma for 4 days. You know, it wasn't my business. It didn't affect my duties of protection.
Mm.
And so I went over, and as I would normally have done on any occasion, you know, I put my right hand in his right hand.
Mm.
And it was immediately grasped.
Mm.
Mm. And so Howells and I are quite sure that he heard Howells announce me.
Mm.
But he wasn't up to opening his eyes and reacting, do you see, except with that very firm hand grip that he kept for quite a while I stood there. And Howells saw, as I did, this bluish tinge disappearing from his face while he held my hand. And he held my hand, I didn't hold his. And it was beginning to turn pinkish again. And Howells stepped forth with a glass of orange juice, bottled orange juice, watered down, of course, and the old man sipped 4 or 5 times. And Howells turned to me and he said, "That's the first sustenance that has passed his mouth in 4 days." And young Winston, seeing the door open, stepped in, you see. And so, I mean, we've got somebody to vouch for this.
Mm.
And he was so overcome, was young Winston, by the appearance of his father's features changing, this metamorphosis. And my holding his hand, you know, one could see that there was an effect there. And he was so moved by this, and he didn't want to spoil it. And he stepped back into the corridor and went into the lounge and waited for me there. And when I arrived there, he already had the whiskies poured out. And he said, "You'll see, Sergeant Murray, he'll do it on them yet again. He'll do it on them yet again." And these are paroles that young Winston spoke, you see, because he'd seen the transformation that had taken place. And so to say that he was in a coma is possibly a little bit far-fetched.
But for somebody, for the Prime Minister, I'm wondering, before then, you know, were they mental, being on the ball and so forth?
Oh, he was very much on the ball.
Mm.
I mean, I think probably the last time we went to Ascot, where one of his horses was running, you see, Prince Arthur, I think it was, immaterial. And we got into the car as soon as the race was over, and he'd gone down to stroke the horse and, you know, give it a kiss on the nose. And then we got into the car and drove back. And when we got to Chartwell, I said to him, as I helped him out of the car, "That was a very good win, Sir Winston, wasn't it? A very good win." Now, when we'd been at the races, he'd been invited by by the Duke of Norfolk, and the Duchess, of course, the Dowager Duchess now, to occupy his box, do you see? And so champagne was going freely. And twice at least, I had to dash down the stairs and out to the bookies to put a couple of £10 bets on for him. Because Walter Nightingale was there and changed his mind and he wasn't sure. But he thought he would win. But Christopher Soames was also probably there, or somebody else, saying that it didn't have a bloody chance, do you see? And so, but when we got back to Chartwell and I helped him out of the car, Jolly good win, Sir Winston. And he said, well, thank you, very good win. Indeed. And did you have a bet on it? Well, I said, how on earth could I find time to have a bet? I was running up and down those stairs, putting your bets on, Sir Winston, with all due respect. No, I didn't. You're very lucky indeed. I did put a pound on you, for you specially.
Oh, really?
This is God's truth. And we went in, and he said, we'll go along to the office.
All right.
And we went along to the office, and I think it was about 15 to 1 or something that had won. He said, now he said, how much does that make? So I said, well, you know, 15, that makes, I suppose about £16 or something like this. And, right, petty cash, and so they got it out of petty cash.
Oh, really?
And I was paid right away.
Right, right.
Might not have been 15 to 1, might have been 5 to 1 or something like that. But nevertheless, the gesture was there. And so this is 3 years before he died, and so if anybody can say that he didn't have all his marbles, how wrong they were.
Right. Well, I mean, during that, but when he was Prime Minister, was he...
Oh, yes, of course, while he was Prime Minister.
Did he sleep a lot?
Oh, he was very, very much more aware when he was Prime Minister.
Yes.
I know he was on tablets, you know, and he had quite a lot of them. Red tablets, you know, lozenge shape and that sort of thing. But that was the nurse's business, not mine.
But he was actually, and he was sick, as in not at work, for several times during his Prime Ministership.
Didn't often happen.
No. I'm trying to work out when the stroke was, but that was when his second year of being a prime minister.
That was second time, yes.
Yeah, but it was
52,
on the
I think.
So he'd been Prime Minister for more or less a year or 18 months at that time.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. But he was incapacitated for about 6 months then, wasn't he, or 4 months?
Oh, no.
No?
I've heard from some funny stories about that period, as a matter of fact, that somebody else was doing the signing for him. Christopher Soames. And I just still don't believe it, but I have it on very good authority. But then, nevertheless, yes, he was out of touch for, yes, it was months. 2 or 3 months, anyhow. Mm. And the Bermuda conference was put off.
Mm.
But there were also other reasons for the conference not to take place then.
What was that?
No, from the other side.
All right.
I mean, from the French and the Americans.
Mm.
But then eventually it took place, of course, and out in Bermuda. And although he was tired, he reacted to everything that happened, and he went for walks down to the beach. And you know, I've got photographs to prove it, and a story about.
When did he more or less start having to go around in a wheelchair?
This wasn't at his request.
Mm.
This was because it was suggested.
Mm.
That in the House of Commons, you know, the long corridors,
yes,
it would be much better. But he always insisted on standing up at the Churchill Arch, and there were always two members of the Conservative Party on duty there, including Dudley, Sir Somebody Dudley, and Christopher Soames was another one. And there were usually two of them, do you see, standing there to take him down. And he always, not like they do today, just throw a nod of the head towards the Speaker. Churchill was always exemplary in his attitude in the House of Commons and would always stop at the bar there to bow respectfully to the Speaker or the Deputy Speaker as he went in. And so the chair would always be there for when he came out for me to trundle him along to the smoke room. Or, in fact, I say myself, but there was always one of the messengers ready to help him.
I see.
You see.
But he didn't. He came in through one of the back entrances.
We came in the back entrance, the ladies' gallery entrance, and because once having got up to the top of 8 or 9 steps there, and through the door, the lift was immediately there, at a couple of feet in, a yard in, and that would take him up to the ladies' gallery if necessary. But we used to stop it on the main floor, and he would get out there. And then he was within 10 paces of his, if he was in power or out of power. One way led to the opposition leader's room and the other to the Prime Minister's room.
Oh, really? Okay.
That was a privilege accorded to Churchill by the Speaker.
Right.
Because the Speaker commanded. That was in the Speaker's courtyard.
Right, right. Did you, just going back to that, did you have much to do with Lord Moran?
Lord Moran?
Moran.
Not really. No. I mean, we greeted each other, we, you know, and we'd have a little chat. I never asked how Sir Winston was. He would say, well, he's a bit tired today, or, you know, words like that. And, but we'd never go into the situation.
Yes.
At all.
Okay. But I think he was out of bed or whatever it was after a few weeks from his stroke, but he wasn't active at all. This is the point, yes, yeah.
And we always had a lift, you see. There was a lift at Chartwell, about, what, from his bedroom, maybe 15 paces to the lift, and the lift went down to the lounge, you know, about another 10 paces to get into that, to his chair.
Well, roughly what year was that that he actually started being more completely sedentary?
Oh, very late, you know. That was after his after premiership.
All right.
It wasn't during premiership.
Just one thing occurred to me back again with that you were saying that he kept, and this was what had been about 1950, that he actually had a loaded revolver by his bed.
Yeah, I can't remember the occasion.
But it was in the 50s. I mean, it wasn't when he was Prime Minister. It was before he was Prime Minister again. Or was it when he was Prime Minister?
No, I feel it was during the time that he was Prime Minister.
Really?
I mean, I went on in 50. Mm. And by 51, you see, he was back in power.
Yes. And I'm just wondering, from your contacts and so forth, I mean, maybe one shouldn't speak about anything that's absolutely contemporary, but have you heard of Prime Minister being armed since? Asking? No.
I suppose that's what special branch officers are there for. You know, to provide the armament necessary. I don't know how many protection officers they've got on the Prime Minister of the day now, but for 10 years, the last 10 years of his life, I was on my own.
No, I just mentioned of that thing of having the Prime Minister with gun. A gun. I don't know whether Harold Wilson had a gun.
I hope I'm right in saying that he had it for a time. Couldn't have been very long.
No.
But I remember it being there. On his bedside table.
Was that the gun from the First World War?
And he probably... Well, it was a Remington that I remember.
A revolver, or...?
A revolver.
Oh.
I'm sure it was a Remington. Stupid.
Hmm.
But, I mean, those things... I didn't go on with Churchill.
No, it just occurred to me.
To take note of everything that he did.
No.
In order to write a book afterwards, do you see?
Yes.
It was the last thought in my head. And I took photographs because I was his official painting photographer. You see, so I took photographs mainly because of the view and the possibility of a future paintings, or to continue a painting or finish a terminator painting. And of course, sometimes the lens would slip and it would be directed towards him.
Right.
I've got one, you know, beautiful thing, and it starts here.
Oh, really?
Of him in a yachting cap with Christina at his side.
Did he take much notice of, you know, the things that, the world events that happened after his premiership?
Yes.
And I mean, I'm talking about Suez and the Hungarian uprising and all that.
Oh, yes, Suez was very important to him.
And Cuban missiles and so forth.
And I mean, he didn't talk to me about Suez. Well, not in so many words.
Hmm.
We would say, you know, how bloody awful it was, or something like that. Or what a disaster, and things like that.
Hmm.
But we'd never discuss the things, you know. I mean, he was more prepared to talk about Sidi Ibrahim or the battles that the Legion took part in North Africa.
Right. But it was for some time after his premiership that people still came after him for advice, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Macmillan, of course, was a faithful performer Eden just dropped him.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons for Eden's downfall, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. He didn't come seeking advice. You know, Mary yes. Macmillan did, and yes. others. And but it was Mr. Montagu Brown, you see, who always kept him abreast of right. the affairs that were happening.
What about Hungarian uprising and that sort of thing? No.
We didn't talk about it. I'm quite sure that he was made aware of the facts as they took place, you see, and he would be most concerned, no
what,
doubt about it.
So, what about, well, things like the Beatles and changing in... Did he ever express an opinion? And that was going on. Elvis Presley?
No.
Uh-huh. Can I just go on the wartime leaders? You said that you met de Gaulle.
Oh, yes. At the Elysee in Paris.
You met once or more than...
That was once, and then he came... No, it was... Who was it that came to La Pausa? I'm not sure.
Tito.
No, it wasn't. It certainly wasn't de Gaulle.
Uh-huh. But anyway, you met de Gaulle, and I mean, what was it between de Gaulle? I mean, what was the atmosphere between...
Well, they were having lunch, you see, and Churchill came down in the lift, and from the an upper floor, and I was inside too, of course. I went inside, and my French colleagues were outside, and because they didn't dare cross the portals of the Elysee, do you see, it's
no.
because there's La Garde Républicaine inside the Elysee, do you see, and on guard at the door, and so that was, they've got a special guard like Buckingham Palace, do you see. So they didn't go in, and but I went in, up the steps and into this wonderful room with that great, those great stairs, do you see, descending. And the old man came down in the lift, and I walked towards him, but he was walking quite well, and he walked across, and then we saw de Gaulle coming towards the end of the stairs. So I suppose de Gaulle was about 5 or 6 yards away. And I was, you know, a couple of yards away from the old man, and the old man saw de Gaulle and looked at me with a twinkle in his eye. Ah, mon cher général, vous devez connaître le sergent Muret. Il a, and so de Gaulle, of course, looked towards me and wondered what was going to happen next, who the devil was I. Il a passé 10 années. Dans votre légion étrangère, le sergent Muret. So there was the introduction. And de Gaulle, what could he do? I mean, there I was, and there he was, and there Churchill was, watching his every move. And so he came forward and shook me very warmly by the hand, but we didn't kiss. And we talked about, he asked me, you know, how many years I'd been and where I'd been. And no, he didn't ask me how many years because Churchill already told him,
yes,
you see.
Yes.
And so he said, you know, he asked where I'd been. So I said, North Africa and Indochina, did the retreat from Hanoi. And so he said, c'est magnifique, c'est magnifique. And I said, you know, something polite.
Mm.
It came to my mind at the present moment.
Mm. How was...
But I think they'd been talking about me upstairs.
Oh, really? I see.
I've got a feeling like that. Because one or two of the things, you know, that he spoke led me to believe that he'd already been warned.
Yeah, I see. Got the picture.
In some way.
Yes. How did you... you're saying that Monty came round a lot. How were things with... maybe move on in a sec to Eisenhower, between Churchill and de Gaulle.
Well,
Churchill,
in his writings, do you see, had made known what he thought about de Gaulle, that the Cross of Lorraine, you know, was his greatest cross to bear, that sort of thing. But I don't think he meant it. I think he was trying to be witty and saying things that were meant to imply to the British people that in no way was he going to be ordered about by de Gaulle.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and that the French had relinquished the battle, or they'd signed an armistice, and that was, you know, a shame. And that the undercurrent was, do you see, that they'd given up the battle, and that it was a dastardly thing to have done. They didn't have to do that. And on one occasion, he even offered them for them to come into the British Commonwealth, you know, as citizens.
Mm.
Which of course was
and
turned
dual
down.
passport,
something like that.
Yes, dual citizenship or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. And so he didn't have a very high regard during the war years after the defeat of France for the French, and so of course he admired de Gaulle for having continued the fight. And so he had a certain amount of respect for de Gaulle, but he still had to tell the British people that he was not going to be ordered around specifically for the hopes of France, that his main object in life was the continuation of life in the British in the British Isles particularly, and the Commonwealth as a whole.
De Gaulle, I mean, always seemed a sort of bit frosty and aloof.
He was always, yes, that was his character. One couldn't change it.
Mm.
He was a religious man, a very religious man.
Really?
Uh-huh. Very strong Catholic.
Yes. And did he, what about, I mean, did he, did Churchill look forward to seeing de Gaulle, or how did that work out?
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. They didn't have much contact after the war years.
Uh-huh.
Or after 1950.
What about Eisenhower?
Different kettle of fish. Eisenhower worshipped the ground that Churchill walked upon.
Really?
But he was also very, very aware of the fact that he represented that great superpower, the United States, do you see? And so he couldn't publicly acknowledge this fact, and yet he always acknowledged this friendship towards Churchill, and he was always delighted to see him. And Eisenhower always had a great big smile upon his face, not only when he met Churchill, but when he met me too.
Really?
He'd always throw his arms around my shoulders.
Yes.
And how's the old man, or how's Winnie?
Yeah.
You know, how's my friend?
Uh huh.
There was a great amity between Churchill and Eisenhower, which was quite absent, absolutely absent, in his relations with de Gaulle.
And they saw each other was relatively frequently. I mean, they crossed the Atlantic a few times.
Yes, and any time that Churchill went across the Atlantic, for other reasons, he made sure that he was going to see Eisenhower. And, on the last occasion, we flew from the White House in a helicopter to Maryland, to Ike's farm, and then in a golf carriage around the farm, for a good hour. So, I mean, it was friendliness itself. It was some. I mean, I could never see de Gaulle inviting Churchill to Le Colombier, to show him around the house and gardens there. He would invite him, of course, to the official functions in Paris, or even Versailles, but never to his private home. Whereas Eisenhower, you see, insisted upon it.
Yes.
And immediately we went.
Starchy, de Gaulle.
Very starchy.
Did he have anything to do with Truman?
Well, we went across to Truman. He didn't care a lot for Truman, but he accepted him, and they were quite friendly. And Truman had a daughter, Mary Truman. I've got a signed photograph from her. And she was she played the piano note Chartwell to entertain. And so Truman always had an entertainer with him, if you like, somebody to you know, to activate things. Mm-hmm. And so he was always, I think he only came once to, I'm not sure that he came more than once to Chartwell. And Churchill went across the United States, I believe, on a couple of occasions.
What did, how did Churchill get along with Macmillan?
Oh, they were great friends.
Uh-huh.
Really lovely friends.
Uh-huh.
And Macmillan worshipped Churchill, really. Mm-hmm.
Mm. No. I mean, it's a silly question, but did you, correct me if I'm wrong, but